What's up, everyone? I'm Andrew Steinwald, and this is Zima Red. On this show, we speak with the users, founders, and creatives that are diving into the world of unique digital assets, also called non-fungible tokens. My guest today is Aaron Wright. Aaron is a mega OG that has been deeply involved in the crypto ecosystem for years. He's a man with many talents, as he's a professor at a law school in New York, played a role in the launch of Ethereum, published a book, sold a company, and is behind many of the major DAOs that we know of today, including the Lao, Flamingo, Neptune, and many more. Aaron gives us a masterclass on all the operational nuances of running these new types of entities and tells us what the future holds for this emergent digital world called the metaverse. If you want to learn all about DAOs, the future of work, and ownership, then this is the episode for you. Please enjoy my conversation with Aaron Wright. Aaron, thank you so much for joining me today. Super excited to chat with you. And to get us started, I'd love to hear a little bit about your background.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks so much, Andrew, for inviting me on. I'm really looking forward to this conversation. My background, it's a bit diverse. I have a background in law and technology. I'm a professor at Cardozo Law School in New York. I've also helped pull together over the past year a number of DAOs, including the Lao, Flamingo DAO, which is focused on NFTs, Neptune, and a handful of others, which hopefully we can discuss. Played a small role helping to launch Ethereum way back in the day. I've had the pleasure of working with a whole bunch of great teams. And even before I fell deep down the blockchain rabbit hole, I did a lot with open source and the Wikipedia ecosystem and their for-profit sister project, Wikia, where I sold the company. And then I do a bit of writing. Like, I co-authored a book, Blockchain Law and Policy, that Harvard published about 2 years ago. And just love everything blockchain.
That is an incredible background. So could you tell me, I think you mentioned that you are a lawyer who works in tech and law. Was that right?
Yeah, absolutely.
So why did you have that focus, or why would you have that interest on tech specifically?
Yeah, I mean, I've always been fascinated with technology. So my dad did scientific research and was employed by the federal government. He was on the internet super early, like the original internet, right, which was used for scientific exchange by like government entities. So I grew up just completely seeing my family online. Like, my dad would be sitting there late at night, like messaging people on a black screen, green font, you know, over the internet. I was fortunate enough to kind of see the whole Web 1 movement in like my formative years, and I just fell in love. So when I graduated college, I was hoping to dive into and work for an internet company. At that time, it was after the dot-com crash. I wasn't able to do that. So I decided to go to law school because I like to write. And then I just kind of fused these two interests together over the rest of my career. So that's kind of how I fell into it. And then, you know, not surprisingly, with a background in like law and a deep interest in tech, like the blockchain conversations naturally caught my attention. I was also an econ major in college, so it kind of hit me and tickled me in all my sweet spots. So I was primed to fall down the rabbit hole.
Yeah, I mean, economics, blockchain, tech, and then law. That is like the perfect confluence of factors to be totally engaged in blockchain. So you said you helped launch Ethereum a little bit. I'd love to hear about that.
Yeah, so I became really, really interested in Bitcoin starting in like 2011. By 2013, I was like pretty steeped in everything. And folks around that time began to conceptualize Bitcoin as a protocol for money, which I thought was a really powerful analogy and one that really resonated for me. And I began thinking about a corollary concept, like a protocol for law or rules. And right around the time that I was thinking about that, Ethereum popped up and on my radar. And in many ways, that's what Ethereum is. It's like in part like a protocol of rules, like these smart contract based systems. And that creates a whole bunch of really interesting dynamics, like scarcity online, something that's akin to property rights, you know, things that we're seeing manifest in large part with like NFTs and metaverse and other areas like that. So I dove in. You know, I paid for a conference ticket, which I had never had done up to that point in time, and was able to connect with Joe Lubin, one of the co-founders, and I just offered to help. It was pretty obvious that it was going to be a tough project to launch, just given the kind of ambition and the challenges from a technical and also regulatory side, and figured I could be of service to help out. And so I just kind of fell in with the folks that were trying to launch it, tried to be helpful, and helped out with that initial event, and then was fortunate enough to help a bunch of teams after the launch kind of get their footing and get moving too. Like, as an example, like I hosted what I think would be like the first Ethereum meetup in like New York, which I think was the first one in North America. So just any way it could be helpful, I always have tried to be that way.
That is so cool. And to know that you've been kind of deeply involved since 2011, 2013, that is crazy. So what was your initial attraction to crypto? Like, was it from the philosophical kind of, you know, I want to be my own bank, or was it more of kind of, as you mentioned before, your interests, which were economics, tech, et cetera?
Yeah, so I was a lawyer working at some, you know, what I think most folks would consider like prestigious New York law firms. Those law firms had to clean up the mess from 2008. And I found it to be a horrifying and eye-opening experience where you just kind of saw the plumbing of the existing financial system and how it went wrong. And in many ways, Bitcoin, beyond being interesting from a technological perspective, which it's fascinating, I just liked that people were trying to advocate for something new and different in a system that I think many folks would agree there's a lot of room for improvement. And I liked that approach. I liked that it was open source. I liked that it was trying to bake in, although there's difficulties with it, you know, more security and privacy preserving technology, which I think is important. And it was just kind of that combination that really, really animated me. I've been, following kind of cypherpunk and cypherpunk related projects for quite some time. So this came from that stew, and not surprisingly, I found it pretty fascinating. And then Ethereum to me was like just a natural extension of all that, right? Like, there was all these conversations back then about how to, you know, basically generalize Bitcoin, and a bunch of teams were taking a run at it, not surprisingly. And I just thought Ethereum and Vitalik and Gavin and the folks that were kind of coagulating around Ethereum just seemed like a really strong team. And I think that's kind of played out over the past X number of years.
Awesome. Okay, so what were you attracted to first? Were you first interested in NFTs or first interested in DAOs?
NFTs. So I also have been an IP lawyer, where I worked in the music industry and did some work there and kind of saw some of the challenges and problems that the music industry had. So as an example, like I've had the pleasure of like representing like Jay-Z and Roc Nation and a whole bunch of other kind of large IP holders. So I was always really fascinated with this intersection of intellectual property and blockchain. And in some very early Bitcoin meetups in New York, which I went to fairly regularly, people began to, you know, kind of ideate on this use case. Like, if you have this, tamper-resistant record-keeping system, you could use it to keep track of money, but you could also use it to keep track of who owned what IP. And that's a big problem. If you've been floating around the media ecosystem for a while, like, it's really hard to prove online that you own the original copy. So I was fortunate enough to like ideate on some of these ideas during meetups with Kevin McCoy, who has been credited with what looks like the first NFT, at least as people seem to associate it with it. There may have been some earlier ones, but it had kind of the first veneer of like a digital piece of artwork. I helped him set up his company, and there was lots of conversations pretty early on about that. With Consensus, I had the pleasure of kind of ideating on this notion of Ujo Music, which was an early project thinking about how to represent interest in a musical work online and also pay out, you know, real-time royalty payments. So I kind of was tangentially involved with that. And so I've always kind of been fascinated with this like subset, and it's always kind of caught my attention. So like when we saw like at the tail end of the boom in 2016 to 18, of token sales, we saw kind of at the end of it, like some projects like CryptoKitties and started to see some other experimentation with NFTs. I thought it was, you know, early, but paid close attention. And then kind of when that proceeded, I assumed at some point that was going to come back to life pretty strong, and, you know, always kept my tabs on like marketplaces, like what SuperRare was doing and others. Just kind of was waiting for the timing to be right. And clearly that's manifested in the past, 9 months to a year.
Incredible. So I feel like next year to say like you're also like an astronaut and like your background is just so crazy. It's so cool to talk to you about this. But okay, so for NFTs, why do you think that NFTs in particular have gained such of the wider quote unquote like mainstream populace's attention comparative to crypto, which has been around for many years longer in some sense and has also made like huge headlines, but I feel like NFTs are suddenly, I mean, especially beginning of January, February this year, NFTs have really caught the attention of just almost everyone.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. And, frankly, I don't know if I have all the answers. So like, I'm like a very instinctual person. I just do things I find interesting and like, and then I just like kind of run at it. So NFTs I always kind of gravitated towards. And we even set up like a DAO back in October before things started pushing more mainstream when it comes to NFTs on the assumption that something would happen there. But I think it's fair to say, and I don't know if you feel this way, but they've kind of exceeded all expectations, which is like a delightful experience. The last time I felt that was really around ETH, like when ETH just like constantly like just exceeded expectations in terms of like adoption, use cases, developer interest. I feel like NFTs are like constantly exceeding expectation when it comes to consumer adoption, artist adoption, enterprise adoption, et cetera. And I think in part, some of that has to do with COVID. I do think COVID kind of accelerated certain trends and the fact that so many creators were, effectively lost their ability to monetize their work, whether that's a musician and doing a live show or an artist and having their work sold in like a physical location. I think that factored it in part. I think too, like on the Ethereum side, because of DeFi, because of, kind of the winter after 2018, where developers had time and space to not just be building hypey things, but the core infrastructure needed to kind of set up this incredible run that we're in the middle of, like that manifested, right? It took time for like marketplaces like SuperRare, OpenSea, Nifty Gateway to kind of mature, made sure that they're secure, develop the tech competency around it. And I think the last thing is they're just really fun. Like it's awesome, right? Like there's nothing better than like supporting a creative worker. I think we see that in like Web 2 with like Patreon and Substack and all these places where you can support creative workers. And here you not only get to do that, but you get to like walk away and own something, which is such a great feeling. And maybe people are just craving like a degree of ownership, which they don't have in Web 2, right? In Web 2, you rent everything effectively. Like here, you can actually own something. There's just something nice about that. I think there's something very human about like owning a collection of some items, right?
Awesome. I love that. Okay, so let's dive into DAOs because I feel like all of your experience and all of your kind of interests all align with DAOs. So first of all, like tell me, like what is a DAO?
Yeah, a DAO, it's a broad concept. So it started kicking around the Bitcoin ecosystem in like 2013. So Dan Larimer, who put together a blockchain called EOS, which was pretty novel in different ways. And Dan, in many ways, was a real trailblazer when it came to kind of mapping out what blockchain technology could do. He came up with this notion of a decentralized autonomous corporation. So he said, and there was a lot of conversations back then around this, how could we use Bitcoin not just to transmit value, but maybe we could represent a Bitcoin, we could color it in some sort of way and start to use that to represent other assets like stock in a company. And he argued, and I think he's right, that if you begin to do that, you can have like A, a more digitally native corporation, and B, certain efficiencies can kind of be brought to life. And then Vitalik and others that were kind of floating around the Ethereum ecosystem generalized that concept into a DAO. So it took this decentralized autonomous corporation and then generalized it into, a decentralized autonomous organization. Because I think people realized it didn't need to be in the shape and form of a corporation, like a hierarchical structure, it could be flatter. And that's a pretty broad mantle of what a DAO can be. I think the easiest way to wrap your head around it, at least today, is to think of it as a group of people, like an online group or community that has a bank account and a whole bunch of rules that are around it. So rules on how to manage the bank account and then rules around how the organization itself is going to operate. So it's flat, or at least aspires to be flat in structure. And it aspires to not be led by like a small group of people, but more by a large number of people who are all contributing kind of at their will. So in my mind, at least as I view it, it's more of like a swarm than like a like hierarchical military grade organization, which is kind of how things operate today. And that works really well on the internet because there's just so much information that's getting thrown at us, right? Like it's really hard to keep up. Like even in the NFT space, like you could spend 15 hours a day on Twitter, reading things, talking to people, and you're probably only gonna cover X percent of all the NFT projects that are coming. So it's really hard for small groups of people to kind of tackle the internet and begin to cut through the noise. And I think that's what DAOs do particularly well. There's other types of DAOs too, a little far field. They're really more focused on kind of managing open source tech, especially open source tech that is relying on smart contracts or hyper autonomous systems. So the thought there is give stakeholders, give folks that are actively using this technology the ability to kind of direct how it's going to develop over time, either set parameters or talk about what can be improved, things like that. So there's a couple buckets of what we're emerging or what we're seeing emerge in the DAO space.
Okay, so, and you mentioned that through a DAO, sometimes you can kind of cut through the noise that is all this chatter online and just kind of get to the signal. How is that the case? Is that just because DAOs oftentimes are, you know, let's call it 20 to 50 people and they're able to, you're just gonna have a lot more eyeballs and ears out looking at what's going on in the market or why can they just like acquire a signal?
Yeah, I think it's bodies, right? Like if you have more minds and people that are roughly aligned along a common interest, right? That's why I like to think of it as like an online group. Like if you're joining an online group, like if it's a subreddit or a Discord or, you know, some channel where people are congregating, like an old school and be like a message board, like everybody roughly has the same interest, right? So you're all kind of thematically in the same spot. And then when you add a bank account, you add incentives. And a big piece of the blockchain story is aligning incentives. I think that's the core innovation of crypto economics and tokens, right? They serve as a way to rally a group of people around an asset. You know, what economists would call like a shelling point. They like serve as a way to like get everybody kind of in the same room, digital room, and kind of pointed in the roughly the same direction. And it's that combination of people that have a similar interest with some sort of kind of unifying structure and monetary incentives that I think just makes it work really, really well. And so from that, when everybody's aligned and you're kind of pushing all in the same rough direction, all these different voices, all these different people are going to start acquiring information and bring it back to the group, right? That's just kind of like human nature. So in the DAOs we set up, they usually have between 60 and 70 people at this point, many folks that have been pretty deep in the ecosystem, whether it's NFTs or the LAO side, it's more on investing in projects, or Neptune, which is more DeFi focused. They're just constantly like filtering information. It's hitting their radar, it's in their networks. So they bring it back to the group. And then once it's brought back to the group, people can begin to, you know, kind of interrogate that information. They can assess whether or not it's a good opportunity, bad opportunity, whether it's something they want to do or not do. So it serves as a point of coordination. So you can kind of tell if your instincts and judgment are right. And then with all the digital tools that we have on a blockchain or just kind of native tools that you can get off the rack from some of these community platforms like Discord, you can pull sentiment so easy. So we really haven't had that ability to do that. Like most companies, if they have a governance decision, it's either has to be done at like a quarterly board meeting or you have to have like an in-person meeting. If it was like a fund, like a weekly meeting or biweekly meeting, here it's 24/7, 365, right? You can always kind of pull sentiment and get a pulse on what people are thinking. And then the last thing that makes it really work is the rules are a little bit different. So I think most organizations today, they really operate via quorum. Like you need a sufficient threshold to be met. The voting is like very rigid. And a lot of the DAOs that we operate, it runs by rough consensus. So it runs a lot like the internet. People that are paying attention at that moment in time, you're trusting them to make good decisions. And if they make good decisions, then you kind of go along with the group. Does that make sense?
Yeah, definitely. It actually goes right into my next question, which I guess you kind of just answered this, but what do DAOs do well that regular companies do poorly?
Yeah, I think what DAOs do well is that information collection. And then I also think it's the information sorting problem that many organizations face. So since it's flatter, information can kind of flow in more emergent ways. And then at the same time, because you have so many voices, it kind of cuts the noise. I think in a lot of organizations, and this may resonate with some folks, like the loudest person tends to win, right? Like the boss is going to tend to win. When there's no boss and everybody's kind of on equal footing, like actual ideas come to light. And you can kind of see people kind of rallying around that in different ways. And I think by not having a leader, everybody just feels a little bit more incentivized to participate, which is nice, right? Like if me and you were forming something, Andrew, and you were the manager, right? Like I'd naturally defer to you, right? Like that's the deal we entered into. You're the manager, right? You're going to figure this out for me. Or you're going to tell me what to do. When everybody's on the same footing, it just opens up a whole new realm of possibilities. And then the last piece is I just think it moves faster. And that's not necessarily just a blockchain thing, but I do think the digital tools that blockchains provide, along with other digital tools that we have at our disposal, just means that we can move faster, right? Like things can actually be in real time. We don't really have real time organizations now outside of the glimpses of what we're seeing in DAOs.
That's awesome. Okay. I really, really love those points. All right. So what do you think regular companies do better than DAOs?
Sure.
Yeah. So I think corporations scale really well, right? Like if you look at the largest corporations in the world, they're massive, right? They administer a lot of value, very complex systems. They'll have hundreds of thousands of people working, for them or, as part of that organization. And I don't know if DAOs are ready for that yet. But I think over time, as we like sort through issues related to governance, like rules, technology, we'll get to that same point, right? Where you can have these very, very broad, huge organizations where there is no leader. And people are kind of pushing all in the same direction. And I think if you look at it like carefully and like think about it, you kind of see that stuff emerging online, right? Like if you think about how some people approach political issues, right? Like there will be a swarm of people with no leader that like emerges online and they'll take some certain action. That could be to like protest something, that could be to, trumpet something up. There's lots of different ways that people kind of already do this online. And what I think is the sweet spot is when we figure out a way to like empower them not just to take an action, like express some upset or outrage, many of which is entirely justifiable, but to actually have like value that they can deploy towards that. I mean, that is super powerful. So I'm really looking forward to that, that type of stuff develop. But look, I don't think it's binary, right? Like I think in the future, if we zoom out, like what are we gonna see? We're gonna see this new emergent structure of DAOs that probably is really good at certain things online, and then I'm sure that there still will be like these top-down, expert-driven, type of organizations too, or board-driven ones. Just like if we look at the media landscape, right, we've got like these emergent podcasters who have huge, massive followings, and then at the same time, we see traditional media, still plugging away, right? Like, I love Netflix. It's incredibly top-down, right?
Very interesting. Okay, so you think that the future is not going to be just everyone has a DAO. You think it's going to be LLCs, corporations, DAOs, and it's going to be based off of your, or I guess the founding member's specific style or even like the use case that the company or DAO is going after. Like, do you think that it'll be structured? Do you think it'll just be structured in any way that the founders desire, or will there be like, if you're going to do this type of company, you should go with a DAO. Oh, you're going to do this type of company, you should go with a corporation. Is that how it's going to look?
I think so. Yeah. I mean, I don't see why it wouldn't. Even if you look at the landscape today, like there's plenty of corporations, there's plenty of LLCs. You know, if you take like a step up and like take a more holistic view, like LLCs have slowly eaten and taken the wind out of corporations. Like corporations are increasingly like a narrow structure that's limited towards companies that are either international. So there's some tax considerations. They want to go public. They want to raise venture capital financing. And I'm sure there's others, but those are like core categories where corporations like check all the boxes. And for a lot of other businesses, like a fund, right, or a consulting company or a services-based company, like a restaurant or something like that, they oftentimes choose like LLCs or even smaller entities than that. So it's a menu, right? And especially in America, we like to provide a million options. So not surprisingly, people will choose different things. I personally think though crypto is like the tip of the spear, like for tech. I think it actually is like the furthest along in like tech trends. And I think what we're seeing is like in areas where there's tons of information that's being thrown, that's really the closest thing to like an entirely digitally native, remote first, like highly disparate, highly decentralized environment, DAOs work really well because there's so much information, right? Like you just need to like aggregate that together. There's a lot of like vetting and information that needs to be done, and groups are just better at that. So if crypto increasingly influences the world, then maybe more and more DAOs will emerge over time. But I think for crypto itself, DAOs work really well.
Yeah, I completely agree with you there. I think we are at the very, very tip of the spear on kind of so many different multiple tech trends that crypto is going to impact in different ways that it's pretty wild to be here now. And just to see the growth from 2017 till today is just wild. And for you, it's been 2011 till today. It's been absolutely crazy. So yeah, okay. So going back to DAOs, what is the ideal, in your opinion, the ideal voting mechanism to get them to go forward with a certain action? Is it like, as you mentioned before, okay, there's 20 people online now and there's this proposal, let's go with it, like let's vote right now? Or is it like we need to get at least 60% of the people to vote? Or like, yeah, what is the ideal method for taking action?
Yeah, I don't think we have the full answer yet, right? But I can just tell you from experience, I do think that, and this is one of the amazing things about DAOs, we have the ability to experiment for the first time, right? With the tools that are available and the low cost in which they can be deployed, you can just experiment. And I think in many pockets of traditional enterprises, like quorum-based decision-making is kind of the king, right? That's the way lots of companies operate. Like you need to hit over certain thresholds to make decisions, et cetera. And I think we found, at least with the Lao, Flamingo, Neptune, and some of the others, this approach of rough consensus seems to work really well. And then there's other experiments that other projects and teams are pushing forward with, like Colony, and Jack DeRose, who runs that project, is really thinking about, well, maybe you only want to veto right? Like maybe by default, the answer is yes. And then people should just be able to veto an action. So you constantly have people moving forward and don't need the same level of high engagement. I could see that working pretty well in certain instances. We haven't experimented with that, but maybe we will. Maybe there's some more complex voting mechanic that you could put in place, like quadratic voting, which Gitcoin and a whole bunch of other projects are experimenting with. There's this notion of conviction voting, right? Maybe you have to like kind of stake something to show like how much you actually care, right? So maybe that works for other teams. So I don't think we have the answers yet. And I think what's the most interesting and exciting part about DAOs, if you're kind of geeked out on governance questions, you get to rebuild the world, right? You get to rethink it from first principles. And I think by doing that, new things will emerge. And then I think at the same time, you'll see kind of respect for some of these governance systems that have operated pretty well via corporations or otherwise too, right? Like maybe quorum-based voting is useful in certain instances.
Awesome. Okay. I want to dive now into all these different projects that you have been a part of because it's just so interesting. All right. First, tell me about OpenLaw. What is that?
Yeah, sure. So literally from the beginning of Ethereum and from, the basic ideas related to cypherpunks, there's always been this notion that you will not just have digital assets, you won't just have a digital property system like what Ethereum provides in part, and Bitcoin obviously provides with digital assets too. You'd also have a system that would mediate differences between the real world and the digital world. And that would be primarily mediated through a contract, a legal agreement. Contracts have been around forever. Like literally the first contracts that they found was in Mesopotamia. And they cover topics that were not dissimilar from what we see today, like employment contracts, marriage contracts, service contracts, lending contracts. So civilization and humans have kind of grown up with contracts always kind of in the background. And now, excitingly, we're kind of exploring what digital contracts look like in their purest form, right? Entirely code-based contracts. But there's certain things that contracts do today that are not accounted for in smart contracts. Things like managing risk, things like calibrating expectations, and dealing with kind of events that can't be easily rendered down into some sort of data object, like an Oracle-based system. So there's a lot of work that needs to be done there. And crypto still needs to operate at least adjacently, if not get entirely integrated into the traditional world. So the notion was Ricardian contracts would help solve that problem. After the launch of Ethereum and after I wrote that book, where I began to think about what that system would look like, I kind of manifested some of those concepts around a project called OpenLaw. So it aspires to be like a recording contracting system that enables you to take a digital, take a legal agreement, entirely digitize it, so represent it in a way that a computer can understand it, and at the same time trigger smart contracts when it's signed. And we've deployed that technology to begin to build out some DAOs, because it seems like it's kind of ripe for that. Maybe I'll pause there.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's incredible. So, yeah, and for you to have the foresight like that early on, I think you mentioned, what is it, 2015? Like, it was the early days of Ethereum. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, it's not my foresight. There was, you know, everybody stands on the, you know, shoulders of others, but folks and great thinkers like Ian Kerr and Mark Miller and a lot of folks that have been, you know, deep into thinking about crypto and kind of this emerging world that we're beginning to see manifest, have been postulating that you need a system like this. And I feel like that's directionally right. So, you know, with that kind of backdrop, it just occurred to me, hey, let's make a run at that, right? Like, let's try to figure out what this looks like. It'll be a fun experiment, and hopefully it'll be pretty useful. And what we found is it is pretty useful. It's not useful in all parts of crypto yet because it's not mature enough, but it seems like it's kind of right sized and right positioned for DAOs. Because you have a group of folks that want to get together, they're managing money, sometimes a lot of money, and for, you know, real folks that have a lot of assets to pull their capital together, they need to know kind of the risks that they're entering into. And so with the LAO and Flamingo and Neptune, some of these DAOs we pull together, we try to basically manage some of the risks that DAOs present. And we saw some of those risks manifest with the original DAO experiment in the Ethereum space. If folks don't know that, it was called the DAO. It blew up, led to a hard fork on Ethereum, which was really traumatic, and many folks in the Ethereum ecosystem still get kind of chided by the Bitcoin folks about it. But it highlighted some risks, right? Like something got really big really fast and went sideways, and like it raised questions like who's responsible for this, and raised questions if you had a lot of assets, like would I be liable for all the harm that was done there? So we tried to kind of square those issues. And used OpenLaw to do that.
Amazing. Okay, so I believe your first DAO was the LAO. Is that correct?
Yeah, exactly. The first DAO was the LAO. And the concept with the LAO was, hey, let's take in the US, like the regulatory regime where it is. In our view, it's what I imagine something like Coinbase's was around that time. Like before Coinbase, there was plenty of other exchanges. They just operated either entirely in the Wild West or were in another jurisdiction. And to Brian and Fred's credit, they basically said, hey, this is a great concept, this exchange model. Let's do it the right way in the US. And they did, right? And it was painful. Like they talked to regulators, they couldn't move as fast as they wanted to. Like they kind of, you know, plodded along, you know, over, you know, almost a decade at this point. Think about a decade. You know, and they built a really impressive institution along that way. Now it may not be as decentralized as people want, and you know, I don't disagree with that at all. But it, you know, fact is, in the US we talk about digital assets because of Coinbase. I mean, Coinbase legitimized the entire industry and they deserve a lot of credit for that. And so we wanted to do the same thing for DAOs. We knew that there was a lot of innate interest, particularly in the Ethereum ecosystem around DAOs, and we wanted to, you know, actually start experimenting with it again. After that original DAO, which I just mentioned, the DAO, and after its collapse, we kind of had PTS DAO in the ecosystem. Like nobody wanted to play around with it. And we started to see some more developer interest. They put together a project called Moloch DAO. It seemed pretty obvious to our team, the OpenLaw team, that we could probably extend that and generalize it and begin to put together these, you know, new DAO-like structures. So we started doing that with the LAO. The idea was to back projects, test out this assumption that like hive mind could actually work. Like test out these assumptions that you could, you know, make fruitful decisions, even though people may be pseudonyms, even though people may not know one another. And we gave it a role and it seemed to work really well. You know, we were able to back some great projects. We were getting pretty strong deal flow, and part of that deal flow and part of the interest was NFTs. So we began to kind of dig in deep, back a lot of great projects in that space itself. And we began to discuss collecting NFTs inside the LAO, and it seemed like a odd fit. So this notion came up that we should set up a new DAO, Flamingo, which would be specifically focused on collecting NFTs. So Flamingo was like incubated by the lab. And the same thing happened with Neptune, which is DeFi focused. Members realized that like DeFi just has slightly different requirements, both technically and also just kind of like focus wise. And it would make more sense to set up a separate DAO for that. We did that as well. So that launched a couple months back. And we've just been rolling. So just to give you a sense between those three DAOs, there's like 140 members. We've deployed about, I think, $25 million in capital, acquired 1,300 NFTs, backed 60 projects, so all in about a year. So it's moved pretty quick.
That is incredible. Okay, so to get like the lay of the land here, OpenLaw is the infrastructure that this is all built off of. The LAO was kind of this, I don't want to say experimental, but it's kind of like another incubator, if you will, for these other DAOs and other projects. And then within the LAO, you guys have created Flamingo and then also Neptune. Is this correct?
Yeah, and then exactly right. So the LAO is kind of like the first experiment and like an incubation center. It's incubated three DAOs. There's actually a couple others, Museo, which is an internet museum, which we just launched. There's also an NFT-focused play-to-earn DAO called Dark Horse, which is focused on Zedrun. There's an interest in forming a DAO around this high-priced CryptoPunk we purchased, an Alien. That's Alien DAO. And I think you're going to start to see a couple more manifest. So when we zoom out and you view the LAO, you can really view it as a network, and probably a network of, you know, next year, about 10 to 20 DAOs, and then probably after that, hundreds. So it's just kind of scaling up.
That's amazing. Okay, so can you, how is that scalable from a individual? Because I can't even keep up with like any Discords anymore. There's just so much going on. So as an individual that wants to participate in, let's say, I want to get involved in a lot of DAOs that I love, how can I do that in a scalable fashion but still contribute in some manner?
Yeah, I mean, I think it happens pretty organically. You see different people have different interests. So inside the LAO, as an example, there's just some folks that have either built projects in the NFT space or completely focused on NFTs. And if there's like an NFT-related opportunity that emerges, they'll chime in. And they'll spend a lot of their time, because they're passionate about NFTs, like inside Flamingo. And they're not alone inside Flamingo, right? There's other people that aren't in the LAO, that aren't in Neptune. They may be digital artists, they may be collectors, there may be other folks that are really like laser focused on NFTs, and they kind of supplement that voice. So you get all these feedback loops that occur. Like I'll give an example. We love generative art inside Flamingo. We've collected tons of art blocks, and we did from the beginning. We were fortunate enough to have Eric, who put together art blocks, as one of our members of, he's actually a member of all three DAOs. And so we began to talk to him like, hey, what are you doing with this project? It's awesome. And so we worked with him, and others worked with him too, that were members of the LAO and or Flamingo, to put together a round. The LAO backed it, Flamingo backed it. And I think it's continued to kind of crush in the NFT space. So we saw something that we liked, had a really strong signal from Flamingo. The LAO came in and also backed it, was able to help pull together a round so that they could have the support that they need to run. And it's like a win for everybody, right? So you get these really cool emergent feedback loops that happen. And people, you know, they participate at their leisure. So one member, as an example, said that it's his favorite game to play. Like, he runs his own fund, but every morning he wakes up and checks out what's going on in, you know, the LAO, Flamingo, or some of the other DAOs that he's participating in, because it gives him a pulse of what people are interested in, right? It's better than Twitter. It's better than the other information he's receiving.
I love that. That's such a cool way to put it. Like, the favorite game to play, I think, is such a cool kind of idea to dive into. But so, okay, so Flamingo, I want to know more about it. Like, explain I know the focus is on NFTs, but are you guys purchasing direct NFTs? Are you guys investing in NFT companies, tokens? Like, I'd love to hear just all about Flamingo.
The answer to that is yes to everything. So there's a broad mantle. So Flamingo started in October last year. When all these DAOs start, it's like literally like a white blank sheet of paper. So there's no like framing up outside of like this idea like, hey, NFTs are fun. So it started with that. You know, we pulled people together, started to facilitate a bunch of conversations, and pretty quickly, like after 3 weeks, these certain strategies emerged in different buckets. So we've basically been just executing on those initial strategies that folks thought made sense. So those strategies were, one, there's going to be a new class of emerging digital artists. NFTs are a new platform for media. And because of that, we're going to see new stars that emerge. Those stars are likely going to be identifiable on large marketplaces like Super Rare, Nifty Gateway, you know, Foundation, et cetera. So we want to support them. We want to identify them and support them. So we were fortunate enough to like commission a whole bunch of work from great artists. And this is, you know, before they, you know, this year has been nuts, right? Before they even like sold works at Sotheby's, right? We were some of the first people to kind of recognize them outside of those marketplaces. So that was one strategy that we pulled together, which is pretty great. And we're continuing to extend that. You know, we're looking at other artists that we think deserve some spotlight and attention. A good example there is like we've been huge fans of IXL. So we've collected a bunch of her works. You know, she did this amazing drop to support Tor, the, you know, privacy preserving browser. And it was great to kind of like help her kind of get pushed in that direction and really, you know, expose her amazing work to the world. The second kind of strategy that we've been focused on is early NFTs. So our hypothesis has been that this is not a flash in the pan. There's going to be millions, if not billions, of NFTs. Priority is millions of them. We're nearing that. And so if that happens, naturally, if you take like a 50-year view of this, the early NFTs are probably going to be notable, right? Like people may look at those NFTs as kind of axiomatic or significant just because they're the first, right? And that tends to happen in lots of different categories. And there, you know, we built up big collections of CryptoPunks and Autoglyphs and, you know, other early NFTs. That's been something we've been really focused on. Kind of related to that, we think generative art is the most unique NFTs in the crypto ecosystem. So we've collected a whole bunch of generative NFTs. The reason we like them is it actually needs blockchain tech, right? Like they're using it for a reason. Number one. Number two, we like the permanence of them. And number three, they're likely going to migrate into DeFi first. So these early NFTs plus generative art, which is entirely on-chain, will likely be the first kind of asset class that gets pushed into DeFi. So that's an interesting experiment. It's a hypothesis. Looks like it's coming.
Are we able to dive deeper into that? Because that's super interesting. Like how will generative art NFTs be the first assets into DeFi?
Yeah. So one of the issues with NFTs that folks know, it's hard to price, right? It's hard to price like a POC work. Like we see some pricing of it, right? If it gets sold by Sotheby's or there's a sale on Super Rare, but you know, his work is pretty disparate, right? Some of the stuff he recently auctioned off with Sotheby's is very different than his earlier work, right? Which is very geometric, black and white, et cetera. It's like lighter or bright. You know, he's more optimistic, I guess, now than he was before, or assuming it's a he. So that's hard to price. You know, with things like CryptoPunks or other works that are more networked, they're set, you can start to get some approximation of pricing. It's not perfect. Nobody's going to claim that it is, but at least you can begin to get some pricing information. And you need that pricing information for DeFi. So if you want to use this collateral, you want to make loans against it, you want it to be, you know, serve in some other more productive purpose. Like we see with traditional art, right? There's a whole bunch of financialization of the traditional art market. It's likely going to happen with these like networked NFTs first. And that in large part covers generative art. And I think we're seeing that kind of manifest. If you look at projects like CryptoPunks, Autoglyphs, if you look at also, you know, large generative art sets like Chromy Squiggles, you're starting to see kind of pricing. I think like Bored Apes, you know, and some of the other, you know, more network projects that we've been seeing over the past 3-4 months. I wouldn't be surprised if one of them emerge out of this category. That's been another area that's been a huge focus.
Love that. Okay. I do want to dive deeper into the I think you said Musea and then Alien DAO, but we'll do that after we talk about Neptune DAO, because I've heard about Neptune DAO. I've heard great things. I want to hear from you. What is it?
Yeah, sure. Should I finish the strategies? Because there's two others.
No, apologies. 100%.
So that's the second one. The third one that we did is just deep in the metaverse, which I know we were talking about before we hopped on this, Andrew, but that's been a huge thesis, right? That NFTs are not just going to be limited to art, right? It's also going to be other property-like things. And I think we're starting to see that first in the metaverse. So we've been, you know, deeply enmeshed in a whole bunch of those ecosystems, either acquiring land or parcels or other items in the metaverse, helping to build them out or build out our parcels. And then also we've been supporting projects on like the more the venture style bet. And then the last one is just like a lot of the sports collectible stuff. We definitely got involved with Top Shot and, you know, some of those early things. So those are the theses that we've been operating. So far it looks pretty good. You know, we'll see what only time will tell, but it's been pretty fun.
So yeah, going off that, are there people in Flamingo that kind of specialize? So there are some people that like love virtual land, some people that love the sports side. Like, is that kind of how it works out, or is it just still a very collaborative effort?
Completely. Yeah. Like there's people that are just kind of more generalists. So they're just like into a whole bunch of different things, but usually for a project, like 1 to 5 people will be just like super into it. Right. So you get like this nice amount of specialization. And then what I think you'll see is like Flamingo metastasize into sub DAOs that are focused on categories when they have enough gravitas to stand on their own right. And so you kind of add in more minds into the hive mind. So I think a metaverse is a great example. Wouldn't be surprised if you see a metaverse DAO from the Lao ecosystem soon. But when you have 70 people that are builders, creators in the metaverse, like their nose is so close to the ground that all those opportunities can merge, right? So they can take a run at that, and then you get a feedback loop right back to Flamingo. Like if there's some opportunity for Flamingo to get involved in some way, then they can.
Awesome. Okay. Now going back to what is Neptune DAO and why is it exciting?
Yeah, so Neptune is great. So, you know, the folks in the Lao, deep in the space, even before kind of DeFi and, you know, staking and incentive rewards and all these types of mechanics were emerging, that happened, you know, frankly, like just over a year ago, right? Like Compound announced a governance token. I think it was back in like May. We were geeked out on it collectively inside the Lao. And people realized it's just different, right? Like you need to claim stake, you need to pay attention, there's risks of rug pulling, there's lots of more complex calculations that need to be done, and there's smart contract risks. So it's just a different risk profile than like venture capital investing or venture capital style investing. So the idea came to mind like, hey, we should pool capital and be value supportive. If a project needs liquidity because they're just launching or you know, they want to make sure that what they're building is useful, we can create a vehicle to do that. And so that's the core mantle of Neptune. It's to build through this same approach, right? Like a hive mind approach, a way to, you know, begin to examine and tackle opportunities in the DeFi space. Unlike the other projects, there's a third party that's involved that's really helping build out the core trading infrastructure that's needed for that. So that's executing trades, monitoring trades, and going really deep. I think the broadest vision of what we're hoping with Neptune is that it's not just one DAO, but a whole constellation of moons that are focused on different parts of the DeFi ecosystem, so different risk profiles, which also has the tech that a larger enterprise like an Alameda would have. But that is actually helping to support projects, right? It's not just completely avaricious. Like there's a degree of community support to it as well, which I think is important. DeFi's tough place, man. It's a dark alley. Lots of knives. Like you need somebody that's like a bit honorable there, I think, as well, too. So hopefully we get there.
That's amazing. Okay, so is there a way that investors or people can get exposure to all these activities and all these DAOs that are being formed? Like will you ever launch a token per each one of these DAOs?
Yeah, look, I mean, we love crypto. There's no native token yet around Flamingo, Neptune, or the Lao. I would love in a responsible way and in a way that you know, hopefully can square with the rules that we have here, explore that. So, well, there's no plans yet there, but I would say there's conversations about how to make something like that happen. Because I think that's the end point, right? Like, I think at the end point, like, we don't just want these vehicles that may be more efficient than traditional funds. Like, the other issue with funds is that the interests themselves do not have any price discovery. And that's super frustrating for folks in the Bay Area that have a lot of their wealth or anticipated wealth, like, locked up in these funds. And I think that there's a lot of demand for it, right? Like, you can actually get efficient pricing on how a group of folks is doing. And that's why I love like projects like Whale Shark. It's awesome, right? Like that's a glimmer of what this can look like. And I think it's fantastic, right? Like you have a group of people, you know, competent person who's collecting great work. And at the same time, like the community can kind of keep him in check, right? He gets the voices and all the benefits of a larger ecosystem.
Very cool. Okay, so are you just kind of figuring out the regulatory issues around potentially issuing a token, or like basically do securities laws have to evolve in order for you guys to do that, or do you think you can do it in a way that is compliant with the existing regulatory infrastructure?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, I think that there's strong arguments to be made that the interests in DAOs are not securities. You know, in many ways, they're more akin to partnership interests. So if everybody can really direct the way a DAO operates, and if they have the ability to not get ripped off. So all these DAOs have an interesting mechanic called rage quitting, where you can walk away with your money. So you have like a lot of control over your assets inside of a DAO. It's different than a venture capital fund or hedge fund. Oftentimes you either have rolling calls for capital, or you have to commit your capital and only have windows to pull it out. And you're really leaning on like the expertise of a couple managers. Here, like you're relying on your own expertise, right? Like you have a say, you have a voice, you have equal access to information. And if there's an issue, you can pull your capital. To me, that makes it feel like it shouldn't require the protections of securities laws. Those are reasonable protections, but like if you're really in control of the whole situation, it's hard to say like you need additional disclosure. Like what's the point, right? You already have it at your disposal. Like, you know, what's going on? It's on chain. It's being provided to you in, you know, different forums, right? Like everything's like for the most part recorded. Like what more information do you need? Like, do you need like audited accounting statements? Maybe, right? Like, do you need complex disclosures that lawyers put together like once a year? Like that seems kind of stupid. So hopefully those arguments can be made. And I think that there's an opportunity for that in the US, but it's going to take some time to get there. I think the right way to make those arguments, going back to like a Coinbase approach, show that there's value, show that you can improve things, show that this is useful. And then I think regulators will at least have a conversation with you about it. So hopefully we'll get there soon.
Amazing. Okay, so you mentioned Musea, which is the NFT Museum DAO, and then also the Alien DAO. I'd love to hear about both those.
Yeah, sure. So Museo was iterated and incubated by Flamingo, right? So I mentioned before how the Lao incubates DAOs, so does Flamingo. And so people recognized after we purchased the Alien, people would just shoot NFTs to the Alien. It was a really interesting concept. We've seen that before, right? Like Jay-Z bought a CryptoPunk, people flood his wallet with like their NFTs. So there's some mechanic around people giving their NFTs in order to receive like recognition. And so we thought this is a super fascinating mechanic and like one that's underexplored, and began to think about where it could apply. And what we came up with was, you know, the Alien, you know, should really support a museum, right? Like we need not just to have marketplaces, which are amazing, not just collectors like Flamingo and others, which is amazing. You need another part of the, you know, art landscape, which is a permanent collection, like some place that can serve as a recognition for the artist, but at the same time store things so that they don't get lost. And so we launched Museo with that concept. Let's create a permanent collection, so things get donated to it, but they're not going to be sold. And at the same time, the decision making isn't done by, you know, musty boomers in like a, you know, boardroom related to some museum. It's actually by the individual artists themselves. So they're the ones doing the curation. So it's incredibly flat. So we organized it, pulled it together. It's a not-for-profit organized in Nevada. And, you know, if you donate a work and the existing members agree to accept it, then you, on a going forward basis, get to decide who comes in next. So it's kind of this like value creative system. And I think it's super fascinating. I think, again, like going out 50 years, I can't imagine that we're not going to see some NFT native museum that sits alongside or is as reputable as something like MoMA or the Met or some of these other amazing institutions that we see across the globe, because it can operate in the digital world, in the metaverse, in the physical world, across the globe simultaneously. It leverages all the benefits of NFTs. Like there's no reason that you don't have one collection that's beamed across the globe like esports, right? Like we've seen this in other categories. So that's going to happen here. And then on top of that, it could become really significant. If you look at the collections of like the Met, MoMA, Louvre, they're massive, right? They're not insignificant amounts of artwork that they're sitting on. They're huge. So we think that that's a really interesting concept too, having a large, hopefully, more valuable set of assets that are managed kind of collectively by a group.
That's amazing. It's such a cool idea about this kind of people setting the NFTs to certain wallets for exposure in some sense. And there's a really interesting, you guys are onto something very big, I think, because there's a lot of interesting dynamics that can come from that. So that's really cool. All right, so we've been talking about all these DAOs and crypto and all this stuff. And you did mention before the metaverse, and we were talking about this before the actual podcast as well. So like, what is the metaverse? Like, why is it exciting and what is it?
Yeah, so the metaverse, I think, you know, anybody that's played any digital game like Roblox or, you know, lots of other kind of comparable systems, we see it coming, right? Like, to in my mind, and COVID really accelerated this, this is the context for the next generation. In the same way that the web or the internet was the context for folks in my generation, and you know, I don't know if you're going to get lumped in that too, Andrew, right? But like, you know, we spent a lot of time like online in an environment that was really dominated by the World Wide Web. And if you go way back into the 80s, though, people imagined the internet being navigated as a virtual world, and people have been aspiring to build them for years. And when you think about what a ideal virtual world would look like, it needs an open, permissionless system like a blockchain to operate. One, because to sustain a virtual world, you need stakeholders, you need people that are, you know, invested in the system, just like you have in a city, right? People buy land, they want to take care of their house, they want to make sure the streets are clean, people are safe. You need similar dynamics for a virtual world, like a metaverse of some sort. And so we've seen a lot of kind of emerging examples, like Decentraland, Somnium Space, CryptoVoxels, Webiverse, right? That are experimenting with how to build one of these virtual worlds, and not just, you know, one virtual world, but a world that's sustainable for the long run. And my sense is it will feel a lot like Bitcoin, right? Or Ethereum. It's going to take years to build these out. Like, you can't build them overnight. And I think there's a strong argument, could be wrong, that some of these virtual worlds that we see, whether it's Decentraland, Somnium, CryptoVoxels, will become like the dominant virtual world. So we've been deeply kind of exploring that. And we think that over the next decade, that's just going to increasingly become important. I know this, maybe folks saw this, but today, whenever this is published, probably a couple of days back, and the Times is even covering this, right? Like, it's starting to mainstream adoption and recognition. So I think it's coming. I think it's probably going to get overhyped like other things, but there's a core concept that's there that's super interesting. And I think the other thing that makes it interesting is there's a relationship with some of these NFT-based games where we're going to see the metaverse and these NFT-based games, or at least the users of these NFT-based games, kind of coalesce together. So it's kind of like we're seeing that already with like NFTs. People build galleries in the metaverse. I think you'll start to see people create gaming experiences in the metaverse. And those gamers will probably become land barons. And then those land barons will probably help build it out. And, you know, kind of this virtuous cycle will emerge. The last reason I think metaverses are interesting is in the blockchain space, literally from the beginning, people have talked about things like real estate on a blockchain. And I think they just always assumed it would be like physical real estate that would be on a blockchain. But I think that you'll see the threads of those mechanics emerge in the metaverse. So like this notion of like, how do we build the technical patterns to digitize real property like land? I think we'll first figure out those technical patterns by digitizing digital property, or like, you know, basically building the technical patterns around digital property first. So the metaverse is super fascinating. It increasingly captures my attention.
Love that. All right, before jumping into closing questions, any news, thoughts, or anything you want to share?
No news. We're just keep on plugging along. So I'll let you know if anything comes up.
Awesome. All right, man. Well, thank you so much for, like, you know, this has just been incredible, but time to jump into the closing questions. All right. First one, what is your favorite video game?
I love Civilization. So,
ooh, yeah. Which one?
All of them, like one through, I played like one through five, like really heavily. Like, yeah, that was probably the game I played the most, like, growing up, and it was like, it was bad. Like, I had to uninstall it. I got like too into it. So,
what was your why did you like it so much?
I don't know. I think it just like really aligned with how I think, like this idea. It's like an optimistic game. Like, you're building out, or you can at least make it optimistic. Like, you're building out a new civilization from start. Like, what's the right way to do it? And so I always built like a civilization that was like focused in science and technology. And, you know, it was usually pretty peaceful. Like, I was never a warmonger, although obviously you play around with that a little bit. I just kind of liked it. It just really had a nice feel to me.
Peaceful until Gandhi shows up. The nukes. Then you know you're done.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. What is your single favorite NFT that you own?
Oh, that's a good one. I'm a huge XCopy fan. I literally get made fun of it inside of Flamingo. So, you know, we couldn't, we struggled to commission a work and then acquire like a XCopy. But we have one, so I'm super happy. And I just think he's great. Really appeals to my aesthetic. It's a little dark mostly, but I like it.
Love that. All right. What is your most controversial thought relating to NFTs?
Ooh, that's a tough one. I increasingly feel that NFTs are actually still discounted right now, which I know is odd, right? Because there's so much excitement around it. I personally think the most emergent parts of crypto will come from NFTs. A lot like what we saw in Web 1 and Web 2. Like, I think people viewed the internet initially as like email and e-commerce. And then what we saw the most innovation around was like social media, right? Like, that's the stuff that nobody could have predicted. I feel like NFTs are similar in the sense that I think they give developers the most flexibility to experiment. They're fun and they're most likely to bring on consumers. So I could see a world in the future where financial products like DeFi is really just servicing a more creative economy where people are trading art, ideas, memes, culture, and that's the predominant markets. Like, that is the market, right? It's not these kludgy tokens or these like archaic instruments like securities. People will be just buying, selling, trading NFTs. So I think that's a little bit controversial. May not be in hindsight. Could be completely batshit. I don't know.
I love that. That is so cool. All right. If you could snap your fingers and instantly change or improve one thing in the crypto space, what would it be?
I mean, that definitely would be regulation. So, you know, I think that lots of the ideas and well-intentioned developers are not being supported enough by regulators in the US. I think that's a generational divide. I think that the previous generations are basically protecting their own bags instead of pushing towards something that's better. And I think a lot of the rules, which are well-intentioned and sensible, they don't firmly work in the crypto space. And we haven't gone through the difficult process of just addressing some of those issues. And we did it for the internet, right? Like, there was a whole body of law called copyright law that had a shift, right? The laws didn't go away, but like, there was tweaks and adjustments that were made federally, right? Like, Congress weighed in on this and lots of other folks weighed in on this. And that enabled a million flowers to blossom. And I think we need to have a similar conversation in the US around that, so that we can see things like community supported financial products, like DeFi, you know, DAOs, make sure that there's clarification related to NFTs and, you know, can you own a shard or not? Like, is that so bad? Like, owning a piece of an NFT, like these types of really basic things with a little bit of clarification would help enable the ecosystem to grow even faster. And I think also more responsibly, right? You're not going to just reward the folks that are willing to disobey the law.
I 1000% agree with that. 1000%.
Yeah.
All right. Last question. Where do you see the world of DAOs in 3 years?
Right. Yeah. So I think DAOs are tracking, in my mind, NFTs and DeFi. If you look at like the numbers, I'll just throw you some numbers if you're not familiar with them. So February last year, so right before COVID, and data's hard, right? But the best estimates, there was about $10 million in DAOs, $10 to $50 million in DAOs, probably about 2,000 to 3,000 users. Depending on how you define a DAO, you're either going to have at a minimum like about $1 billion in it, at a maximum like $100 billion in DAOs today. And the number of users is, you know, in the hundreds of thousands. So we've seen this exponential growth related to it. And I don't think that's going to abate. The big challenges in the next 3 to 5 years for DAOs is building out the tech tooling. It's a lot like NFTs and DeFi. Like, a lot of the tools are really crude right now. They're not ready for prime time. They're not consumer focused. So I think it's going to take a lot of work to build out, you know, more modern tech for DAOs. And once that's there, I think you'll start to see them kind of continue to grow in force. And I don't know if it's 3 to 5 years, maybe it's 5 to 10, 10 to 15, but I think at some point you're going to see one of these organizations, they're going to be massive. They're going to be, it's going to be a household name, and it will sit like alongside other large companies, right? Like, it'll be like Coinbase, and like a DAO will be sitting there at some point too. So we'll get there, but the tech's got to improve. You know, some of those governance questions that we talked about before, we got to figure out those issues, and it just got to gel and mature.
Amazing. Awesome, Aaron. Well, this has been an absolutely insane conversation. I loved hearing about your background. I didn't realize you've been involved in this space for such a long time, and it's just incredible to hear. And also just hearing about how you just got attracted to, you know, crypto, NFTs, DAOs, and what you're doing now in the space of DAOs is incredible. You're building out the infrastructure. You're really on the forefront of NFT DAOs, of liquidity DAOs, of you know, the LAO, which is a DAO incubator. Like, you're just doing incredible stuff and really moving the space forward. So hats off to you for that. If people wanted to find out more about yourself or find out more about what you're doing, where should they go and what should they do?
Twitter is always great. You can follow me there. It's AWRIGH01. And I, you know, just want to thank you, Andrew, because I think you've been amazing in the NFT space. You have pushed things forward.
Thanks.
I think you have a great collaborative vibe to you, and I really appreciate that. And I've always enjoyed our conversations.
Awesome. Thank you. Thank you so much, Aaron. It's been a pleasure chatting, and looking forward to our next chat.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, thanks, man.
Hey, everyone. Stay tuned for more episodes of the ZemaRed podcast and subscribe to the ZemaRed newsletter for more info on all things NFTs. Thanks so much for listening.